Consequence Podcast Network.
The magic of radio memes. Nobody knows that's just Diet Pepsi.
Always Diet Pepsi.
So you've had an experience, Clint.
Yes.
It's a significant experience in the life of every young person. Mm-hmm. Not that we're particularly young, but you know what I mean.
Youngish.
You watched your first episode of RuPaul's Drag Race.
I did last night.
We'll get more into it. Mm-hmm. But what I want to know is, what do you absolutely have to know right now? Like, what indecipherable thing? Because Drag Race is like jokes on jokes on jokes, right? Like, somebody made a reference in season one, then somebody changed that reference in season two, and then somebody else changed that reference in season three, and it's like mm-hmm. become a thing, and then a thing, and then a thing. So,
okay,
if you have one question, what is your one question?
Who is Michelle Visage and why is she important?
Oh, well, because she's fucking sickening.
Yeah.
There's more, but that seems like a good place to say, welcome to TV Party, a podcast of the Consequence Podcast Network. I'm Allison Shoemaker.
I'm Clint Worthington.
And that's it for right now. That's so exciting.
It's a TV party of two.
I'm kind of stoked about it, actually, because you know what? Fuck Caroline Cena. I couldn't even say it with a straight face. I love Caroline.
They will be missed. R.I.P. in peace.
We just thought, you know, we haven't done a two-person TV party since our little teaser episode, and we thought maybe it was time.
Well, this way we have more room to talk about the things we want to talk about. Cool. We don't feel like
yes,
we need to
exactly
stuff too much in there.
And specifically, because this is your first Drag Race episode, I felt like I needed a lot of time.
Yes, I needed a post-mortem with you.
So Michelle Visage, we'll return to the rest of Drag Race when we get to our consensus pick, which I guess is actually like right away. Mm-hmm. We have news, whatever. What?
Sure.
Fuck it. We're doing Michelle Visage right now. So Michelle Visage is most importantly just one of RuPaul's besties. Mm-hmm. They were on the RuPaul show together back in the day, back in the 90s when that was on VH1. I never remember if it was MTV or VH1. Mm. I think it was VH1.
Okay.
She was also in a girl group called Seduction. Maybe we can play.
They did make a crack about Seduction.
Yes.
There, yeah.
There's at least one Seduction crack every season, usually more than one. She's done a lot of radio. She's a big radio personality over the years, but mostly she's just Ru's friend.
So she's RuPaul's Gail.
Yes. But without the warm fuzzies, which is not to say that Michelle doesn't occasionally have warm fuzzies. And mm-hmm. they, like, clearly love each other very fiercely. They also have a terrific podcast called What's the Tea? She is the harsh judge. In the Drag Race guide that hopefully will be on the site by Monday.
Fingers crossed.
It's supposed to be on the site on Monday. So if it's not there, sorry, it'll be there soon. Mm. It's an update to a guide we published in January called The Essential Guide to Finally Starting RuPaul's Drag Race, which I have to say, I swear to God, actually came out of not me thinking I should write something for the site, but from me writing a list of Drag Race episodes for Emily Stevens, the AV Club's Emily Stevens,
okay,
who wanted like a crash course in Drag Race. And then I thought, I should probably just make this a thing. And then anyway, that's where it came from. In that piece, I talk about all of the judges and I say that Michelle is the savage one. And she absolutely is. She is mm-hmm. just savage. But she is usually right, which is the makings of a great reality show judge. And she also wants everybody to be good. It's not like a Simon Cowell situation. Like, she wants people to be good. So even when she's issuing sick burn after sick burn, it's done with love. So that's Michelle Visage.
Right. So coming from a guy who normally watches cooking competition shows, Michelle Visage is the Amanda Freitag of Drag Race.
As a person who doesn't watch much cooking shows.
Well, she is also the very stern, harsh judge, but it always comes from a constructive place, but she's often a queen of the arched eyebrow during someone's particularly weak description of the
ooh,
dish.
Well, then they have that in common because Michelle has a fierce brow game.
Excellent.
Just like the fiercest brow game. Beautiful. She also wrote a book recently called The Diva Rules, which I have not read yet, but Michelle Visage, She's fucking cool. So, obviously, our consensus pick of the week is going to be the season premiere of the 10th season, not the 10th decade. This is really bothering me.
I remembered that whenever they kept referring to the decade.
It's not 2009. I remember this very specifically because Drag Race started like maybe 2.5 weeks after I moved to Chicago. Mm-hmm. So I was subletting. I would haul my ass to my friend's sketchy apartment in Uptown, and we would watch Drag Race on Logo. And nobody else I knew was watching it because no one was watching Drag Race then. I remember when the first episode aired, and it was 2009, and it is 2018, and that is not a decade. Anyway,
right.
We will be talking about the season premiere of the 10th season of RuPaul's Drag Race. Tens across the board.
I know what that means.
Yes.
Yeah. Getting so much context.
Well, just watch Paris. First of all, you should watch Paris is Burning.
Oh, I have. I have. Okay. I did get that, so that you got Drag some 101. Of
the, yeah.
There was just
Butch
like.
Queen. Yes. First time in drags at a ball.
The only one I had to look up was Trade, because they did not discuss that one in
Paris
is
Burning. And that's not so much a drag queen
thing. That's more
of
a,
Trade. Rough Trade.
Right.
Anyway, we'll be talking about that when we get to our consensus pick of the week, which is, you know, just shortly. But first, there's a bunch of really cool TV news.
Yeah.
So, Clint, I know there were some things you were excited about.
Sure. Just a couple things. First off, all of Monty Python is headed to Netflix, which is something I'm very excited about. I wonder if that means just the series, or if the series and the movies, and the series and the movies and the concert shows. I'm not sure, but the impression that I'm getting is that like the entirety of the Monty Python catalog is headed to Netflix. And
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I'm just really, just in general, excited about that.
Yeah, and I feel like Hulu has been the one that's been sort of killing it and acquiring stuff to put on, older stuff to put on their streaming service lately.
As anyone who has craved a Golden Girls marathon recently can attest. But
Living Single, too, that was a big one.
Also true.
Yeah.
Also, I haven't been watching Fargo, but apparently season 4 is going to be a period piece. I don't think they've specified which period, but I think that's going to be really cool. I watched the first season of Series of Unfortunate Events. It was okay. I'll probably end up watching season 2 because I'm a completionist. But Allison Williams has been added. Apparently she's going to be in seasons 2 and 3, so that might be nice. And also the trailer for Marvel's new show Cloak and Dagger came out, which is also very intriguing. The two leads seem fun, the mystery seems interesting, and the idea of two people who have powers that interact with each other to be even more powerful is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Marvel's had success with teen-led superhero shows with Runaways, so I have good feelings about that. And it's Freeform show.
Yeah, Freeform is killing it right now. Did you watch any of The Bold Type when that was on?
No, that's why I forgot about it in the write-up. Thank you for adding that.
No worries. When you have time, it's not like any of us has time, really, but it's a short season. The Bold Type has a couple of missteps, but it does some things just incredibly well, and that young cast is really great. Yeah, I'm looking at this Noah Hawley news about season 4 of Fargo. And all he really said is that it's like season 2 is going to be set in an earlier era. So I don't think that necessarily means like Elizabethan.
I'm just looking forward to, I want Gangs of New York, Fargo. That's what I want. Yeah. That's my desire.
My desire is for them to find a way to put Ray Wise in it again. That's
or just Fargo caveman times. That's what I want.
No, I don't. Good Lord.
Oh.
No. All I need for, like, of caveman times, as he so delightfully put
yes.
is that that episode of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend where Rebecca picks nits out of Valencia's hair.
Yes.
That's all I need.
Good.
So my piece of news I'm excited about is that Margot Robbie is producing a female-focused Shakespearean drama series with the producer of Secrets and Lies, and I am so excited! You missed it, but I wish that Clint had been recording like 30 seconds before he was, because I was reading this deadline article and got to let me see if I can find the exact sentence. Here we go. A new 10-part series retelling the work of Shakespeare from female perspectives. And I just am still really excited about it. Nothing has ever been made more just for me. Like, I guess perhaps if she was also involving RuPaul or
RuPaul as Lady
Macbeth.
Or if it
was a musical.
Yeah.
No, RuPaul doesn't have that darkness. RuPaul's all about love.
Yeah.
RuPaul would need to be like Titania. Fuck yes. RuPaul is Titania.
We're casting this.
I'm into that.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, it's great. Like, obviously, if we're doing from a female perspective, that means we will obviously be getting some sort of Lady Macbeth installment. We'll be getting an Ophelia installment. Mm-hmm. I would bet on a Cordelia installment or maybe a Goneril if they want to do something a little more unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Ophelia, Cordelia, maybe Amelia Bedelia.
Oh, God.
Wordplay.
Doing Viola would be too easy, but if they did mm-hmm. Olivia from Twelfth Night, that could be really cool.
I mean, I'd be cool with even just doing some gender swapping. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, like, there's no reason they can't do that.
Yeah, but I'm more interested in
fleshing out the actual female characters.
Yes, because there are some obviously great female characters in Shakespeare, but they mm-hmm. are typically second banana.
Yeah.
You know, it's not called Lady Macbeth.
Yeah, that's true. It's called Macbeth. You know what? Let's make them first banana.
Let's make them first. I agree. Mm-hmm. Well, and presumably that means she's going to be in it too, which is mm-hmm. good fucking news for all. Yes. I love that we are in an age when movie stars are like, fuck yeah, I'll do TV.
Yeah.
Bring it. I can't wait. Mm-hmm. I want all of it. Give me all of that TV.
Right.
Michael Shannon is getting ready to jump on HBO. That's going to be great. Yeah, like, yeah. I just, there's all
Well, Michael
of good
Shannon
shit.
Does, it, that, he's just such an anomaly, too, because he still just pops up to Chicago occasionally to do a Red Orchid show, you know?
Well, I mean, he does run that company.
It's true, but Help still, like, company, it's astonishing that he still finds the time to do it, you know? Mm-hmm.
He's a man who knows what he wants.
Very true.
And what he wants is to watch the Oscars.
At Old Town Ale House by himself.
Old Town Ale House. I hope everybody left him the fuck alone. That's what I'd want if I were him. Yes. Anyway, so that is the big news of the week with one other minor thing, which mm-hmm. is that Ken has officially decided that Netflix is not allowed to submit films to its festival.
Yeah.
They also banned selfies from the red carpet, which is less interesting.
Yeah, it's true. But I mean, between that and Steven Spielberg, basically, he said in an interview at some point recently that Netflix movies shouldn't get Oscar nominations. Like, we're getting into a weird kind of like pushback now with streaming films, like, and to what extent we treat them as like actual movies or as like TV movies of the week, you know?
Well, that's complicated, right? Yeah. Like, all of it's really complicated because there have been a lot of great, hugely influential movies made for television
mm-hmm.
in the past. I mean, by HBO, right. Like, all kinds of. So then, if it's a movie that's made for television, but it's on a network and not a streaming service, should those be eligible for Oscars? I mean, obviously Going Clear was.
Yeah.
HBO has found a way to do extremely limited releases that qualify some but not all of their films for Oscar consideration. Mm-hmm. But if Netflix is doing the same thing.
And then there was that hubbub about OJ Made in America mm-hmm. not long ago. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, and the thing is, like, Netflix hasn't had a really good track record lately, and I wonder if part of that backlash is sort of fueled by that. I don't know. Maybe, like, after Mudbound, they haven't really released a really good movie. Mm-hmm. Between, like, Bright, Mute, Cloverfield Paradox, and now Game Over Man, which, don't watch it, but read my review at Consequence of Sound. Netflix is becoming quickly synonymous with, like, the new, being the new direct-to-video format.
Yeah, but they got some great shit out of it's Sundance, true.
Like,
didn't they?
I think so, but it feels like they dump it. They dump it all, like, I don't know. Their big event movies are just garbage.
Yeah, I don't. I feel like we are closing in on the conversation when we have to start deciding what is the difference between a movie and a television show.
Yeah.
And if the only difference is that one is serialized in like 42 1-hour chunks.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's going to really change the way that we award, specifically that we award films. I don't think it actually changes all that much for the Emmys per se.
Yeah.
Because if it's made for television, then it qualifies, right?
Right.
But if something is made for television and theaters, then what is it?
Right.
The
lines are getting fuzzier and fuzzier, especially as people start going to the theaters less and just enjoying their content at home, you know. So
yeah, it's, well, we should close this
yes
in the only way possible, which is to say that Twin Peaks the Return is not a fucking movie.
Stop deluding yourself. Film Twitter, I know you liked a television show, but that doesn't make it a movie.
It's okay for a television show to be extraordinary.
Yeah, TV shows can still be good.
Yeah, and I just it doesn't what none of y'all were saying, the People versus OJ was a movie, so get off my nut. Like, I don't, like, I just don't, it doesn't make any sense to me. And I understand exactly one aspect of the argument, which is if David Lynch says it's a movie and he made it, then I guess it's a movie. And I understand that, but he put in a fucking credits roll at the end of every hour.
Yeah.
That we were supposed to watch because the action continued during it. It's not like it cut abruptly and then there was like black screen and credits.
Right.
He created, like, specifically we ended at the Roadhouse. We would see the credits roll. It was a part of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fucking television show.
Yeah. And you know what? We'll talk about this later, but Danny Boyle has directed all the episodes of Trust. Does that make it a movie? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. Sorry,
but
Danny.
But I am excited.
Yeah.
I do love Danny Boyle.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So with that, it is probably time to move on to our consensus episode of the week. And we are going to use this opportunity to sort of test the waters for a format we'll be revisiting in early April, I guess technically like mid-April, that we've been itching to do for a while. It's part of the reason we've been itching to do it is because it is our favorite name for any of our formats we've come up with. And the name is Just Do This For Me.
It's very aggressive.
Just Do This For Me.
Okay.
So last night when Clint and I were deciding what our pick of the week was going to be, and there was a lot of great TV this week, but there wasn't one easy standout. There wasn't one thing that we both loved. So I said, Clint, just do this for me and watch the 10th season premiere of RuPaul's Drag Race. And he said yes.
Mm-hmm.
So in this format, we're going to get someone who's totally new to a thing to watch something, and then we'll have a conversation about it and basically answer lots of questions too, right? Like, we'll get to immerse somebody in the culture. We'll bring the news to the children, as RuPaul might say. When we do this properly, when we do our first full Just Do This For Me episode, I can't wait. It will be Clint and I both watching WrestleMania for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
With Dominic Suzanne Mayer. And then we will do an episode in the format of Just Do This For Me with fucking wrestling experts Dominic and LaToya fucking Ferguson, who knows her shit, and they are gonna just immerse us in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel sweaty already.
Yes,
I'm very excited about it.
Well, words cannot express how excited Dom probably is for this.
Oh,
too.
He can't wait.
Yeah,
he cannot wait. LaToya was like, sure, I'll talk about wrestling whenever. I was like, seriously? Yes. So Clint,
yes,
you watched Drag Race.
I did.
Talk to me about it.
Okay, so just as a little bit of context, I only have a very passing familiarity with drag culture and stuff. I've been to a drag show or two in my time. I've worked with people who on shows and like performance theater and stuff who also moonlight as drag queens. So I get a little bit of osmosis from that. And like we said before, I've seen Paris is Burning. So that's my like drag 101. And, you know, obviously RuPaul's Drag Race has been in the periphery for a good long time. So I get something every once in a while. And also, honestly, since we started the podcast and talking about Drag Race, like
sure,
that's also the most like the little like inching up to the line sort of primer for it. But this is the first time I've actually seen it. And, you know, as someone who has seen his fair share of reality TV competition shows, it's great. Again, the reason I didn't see it, I've mentioned this in earlier episodes, is just it's kind of the same reason that I get sometimes about people who are afraid to get into Star Trek, because there's just so much. It feels like there's so much.
Yeah.
But unlike Star Trek, like, you can go into a season relatively clean. Like, mm-hmm. it's its own discrete unit. You just, you know, it's all 10 Little Indians, basically, where you just, like, whittle down to a winner. It's the classic reality competition thing. So I felt comfortable coming in relatively blind. I mean, apart from knowing some basic things about drag and knowing who RuPaul was and that kind of stuff. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. Obviously, the primary appeal is the queens and how they interact and their beautiful costumes. And I should have realized before that the show is perfect for me because its pun game is on point.
Oh, there's so many puns.
So the judging segment was particularly fulfilling for me. Yeah.
Which one was your favorite?
Oh, God. The ankh ankh thing that the queen who made it didn't even get.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is an ankh? I didn't know. I will say I'm having the slight problem right now of that I have in every sort of reality TV competition early on is that I'm having trouble, you know, keeping track of everybody. Like,
sure.
I mean, even with these queens with their distinct looks and stuff. But then there's things like, two queens have a bit too similar looks and they have a little bit of history with each other, like Ms. Cracker and oh God, what's her name? Aquaria.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which becomes a thing. And I'm wondering if that's going to be a bit of a rivalry that's get set up. But I'm instantly glomming on to some of the bolder personalities. I love the queen from Chicago.
Vixen.
Yeah, the Vixen.
Southside protest queen.
Yeah, yeah. I loved her initial outfit. And then the first challenge is like, oh, I don't know. She might be from Chicago with
that's,
the big emblazoned.
Jinx Monsoon. Uh-huh. I'm so excited. I was so glad that this is the episode that you agreed to watch because it's an extremely fast introduction to some of the best queens from the show. There are a lot, not all of the winners were in that audience, but a lot of them were, and a lot of fan favorites. That's Jinx Monsoon, one of my favorite winners, who came in like scrappy underdog. Some of their looks were a little bit busted, but charm for days, in just an incredible amount of charm, and then specifically came into the Snatch Game, which is the match game episode, and did Little Edie and took shit the entire episode from all these other queens who were like, who the fuck is even gonna know what that is? What a terrible choice. And I just imagine gay bars round the world, a bunch of like 21-year-olds being like, yeah, who's Little Edie? And then a bunch of people who aren't 21 being like, what the fuck?
They don't even know what the best costume for the day is.
Just come on. Right. Own it. Like, this is your culture. This is like, she's a fucking icon. Get into it.
Right. I feel like when you come out, you get like a little gift basket that has at least one DVD of Grey Gardens in it.
It should, at least.
And a little bandana.
Anyway, it's she is great.
Uh-huh. But I will say that the queen right now that I am most on board for is Eureka, the one who apparently was a holdover from season 9. Again, I'm new, so I didn't know. How far did she get in season 9?
Oh, it was maybe episode 4 or 5. Let me
dropped out early.
Check. Well, injured herself.
Yes,
so she made it a couple of episodes after. They did a cheerleading challenge, and she did a kick or a split or something, and you can see like she obviously hurts herself, but just keeps going. Then in the next episode is on crutches and does the runway on crutches. Eureka in that season, I was a little hot and cold on. She's great in the first episode, but was a little hot and cold on. There was a little drama. There was a little, it's not always my favorite thing, a little insecurity, which is a very common thing on the show. People get very in their heads about being there and being surrounded by all this beauty. But when she hurt herself, it was like, well, fuck it. Got to do what you got to do. And she just kept going. She worked her crutches into her outfit, everything. But then on the runway in this challenge that she had done really well in, Bruce said, we've heard from the show doctor or whatever, and your injury is severe to the point that we can't in good conscience have you stay on the show. You could injure yourself in a way that you can't recover. So you have to leave. But this is me saying you can come back for season 10. And she burst into tears and it was very sad. And so nobody got eliminated that week because Eureka went home. But I've been excited for Eureka to come back since then because she was so graceful about it and so excited. And God, what an advantage having been there a little before. It's happened a couple of times on the show can be. And you can tell that she has learned some lessons the first time around because of her like tour of the workroom asking everybody what they're doing, which is the single best way to make sure you get a shit ton of camera time.
Yes.
Like she was in so much of this episode and she was in the middle. Usually you're getting camera time if you're in the top or the bottom, but this was like, nope. She went and asked everybody how they were doing, and lo and behold, Eureka may have had more screen time than anybody else.
Right, including, and I'm not doubting the authenticity of this moment, but the big crying moment where she talks about the the recovery and everything and her doubts about being able to come back. That was really interesting.
And
I think she's
getting sick.
And she's one of my favorite queens. And it's just really interesting. I'm wondering as we keep going, like as the herd sort of thins a little bit, like which queens I'll end up sort of changing alliances with and everything. It's very fascinating. One of the things that I didn't expect was learning more about the background of the specific drag scenes they come from. Like there's a lot of New York queens and they all know each other, and then the rivalries from outside the context of the show, and things like the queen who was eliminated this week comes from a big drag family, a drag empire as she calls it, and like those are things that are sort of new to me.
Yeah, there are a lot of drag families, drag houses, are always sort of interesting to follow on the show because from the very beginning, there have been drag mothers and drag daughters popping up on the show. A drag mother typically sort of helps a younger queen learn their trade. Obviously, there's also friendship and kinship, and they perform together a lot. Mm-hmm.
But it's also a way to bring a pre-existing reputation onto the show,
totally.
Too, like a cachet.
And there are names that go along with a lot of these. So, like, obviously, Ms. Cracker does not have Bob the Drag Queen's drag name, but she is from the House of the Drag Queen, which is Bob the Drag Queen's house. Mm-hmm. But Vanessa, the queen who was eliminated this week, Snidell alert. Vanessa is the drag daughter of Alexis Mateo, who was... God, what did she? I think maybe she was in third. She came in third in season 3, mm-hmm. And then was also on All Stars in the first season of All Stars. She's a Florida queen, Latin queen, mm-hmm. Who says "Bam" a lot and is great, like nice. Really, really great queen. I was really hoping that Vanessa was going to shut it down in the lip sync because Alexis is like a great lip syncer, and she just didn't. Here's a fun thing to know about Drag Race.
Okay, yeah.
If you ever hear anybody use the phrase lip sync assassin, what it means is that they're so good at lip syncing that they just keep staying on the show even if they wind up in the bottom because they will just shut anybody down. And once somebody gets a reputation as a lip sync assassin, you can tell that other people don't want to go up against them, or if they do, they specifically strategize around what they know about that queen. There's this incredible moment in, I think it's season 8, where Laganja Estranja, who is from that House of Edwards, by the way, Alyssa Edwards' house, well, with Shangela also, had been sort of a lip sync assassin. When I think lip sync assassin, I think like Peppermint, who is the season 9 finalist. She could do this great move where she would kick all the way up to her head and then fall into the splits. Super cool. And she would bust it out at like the big moment in every song every time she lip synced. And she was in the bottom a lot. So finally, she's in the bottom after this episode where she had a total meltdown. It was very sad. Up against a queen, Jocelyn Fox, who I don't think we had ever seen lip sync before. At the very least, it was not particularly memorable. But you can see when you watch it, there's this moment where you can tell that Jocelyn is watching Laganja out of the corner of her eye, and Laganja's foot goes up. So Jocelyn's foot goes up and they both kick up to their head and land in that split. And because Jocelyn had never done it before and made it simultaneous, she like smoked her. Nice. Just like totally assassinated her. So I was hoping that that Vanessa would be like Alexis and would be a little bit of a lip sync assassin, and she was not. But
no.
But Calorie Kardashian Williams, yes. I think, did a pretty great job. I wish she hadn't had such a hard time getting the cash out of her boobs, though. She really struggled.
No, you can tell that was a moment of sheer inspiration for her in that moment. She's like, oh no, I've got this money. I need to make it rain. I love that little bit of inspiration.
Get it out of here. Bam!
But there's an element of improvisation to this, too, as much as they prepare and everything, too.
Totally.
So it's a testament to just the sheer preparation of their characters and just their incredible energy.
Okay, so what other questions might you have?
Ooh, God, that is a good question in and of itself.
I'm putting you on the spot. So if you don't have questions. I can also just sort of prepare you.
Is this sort of the general quality of the strength of the episodes going forward, or was this a particularly good episode of the show?
It's a good premiere.
Yeah.
No one is going to make a list of the best episodes of Drag Race ever and put this one on it. But premieres are often a little overstuffed. There are a
this
lot
was
of
like
queens.
An hour plus. It was like
VH1 is giving Drag Race basically 2 hours every night. This should give you a sense. I don't know what the exact ratings are, but it should give you a sense of what a hit it is for the network.
Right.
Because this is the first year since, God, I don't know, probably like 2011. I'd have to check, and I'm not gonna right now because loud typing is obnoxious, but. Untucked, the like behind the scenes show that airs right after, aired on Logo for a while, for I think season 2, maybe 3, and then was online only, and that was it. VH1 was like, oh no, let's put that on television too. Let's do a solid 2 hour Drag Race block every week, which is I think an indicator of how big the show is for them. Anyway,
absolutely.
Yeah. So these premiere episodes tend to be pretty crowded. Everybody gets their intro moment. There's a mini challenge. There's always some sort of cool guest judge. Last season it was Lady Gaga, and the moment when she walked in, she actually came into the workroom like she was another drag queen, and you got to watch people like go
figure it
out. God, that is a great Lady Gaga impersonator. That's the best Lady Gaga impersonator. And then you see them go like, what?
Good.
What? And then it cut to like an interview with her, and she went, "I'm Ronnie from New Jersey," and it made me laugh so hard. Anyway, it was a better trick here than them saying that Christina Aguilera was Pheromone, a contestant from last season.
Yeah.
Who in profile, like, they're both tiny. Mm-hmm. It was really something. But then you get the full challenge, and everyone has a runway look. It's often a construction challenge like this one was.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot, and you tend to not get to know anybody, really. And that wasn't the case here. I feel like this was a really well-directed, specifically perhaps because they had this extra half an hour, episode where you really got a sense of a lot of the queens. So one of the better premiere episodes, but no, the season tends to start to get really good once the herd has been thinned just a little bit. Snatch Game is reliably one of the best episodes of every season. There, even a bad Snatch Game is great because, God, watching somebody just utterly fail at doing a celebrity impression and catching punchlines, because that those episodes, you'll see, are all about Rue, like, set teeing somebody up for a joke and then half of them like whiffing, just like totally missing.
Which that was one of Ms. Cracker's strengths.
Yes. Yeah, she she was great. She fired him back.
Yeah.
There are no accidents in fisting is like a great Drag Race line.
Yeah.
Instant gif. People will be quoting it.
And a great fortune cookie slogan.
Yes. So yeah. It's my favorite. Every time I get that, I'm really excited.
It's nice. Yeah. Magic number 69.
Yeah. So, yes, a great premiere episode, not necessarily a great episode of Drag Race, but a good one. And it bodes really, really well for what's to come. A lot of the queens were funny. A lot of the looks were great. Those construction challenges can be a fucking nightmare. And almost everybody did pretty well.
There were just those things like, well, like Michelle Visage's like sort of arbitrary distaste of the queen who puts the dots on her face. I forget who it was, but Dusty Ray Bottoms.
Yes.
The other judge made a good point about like, yes, you know, it was inventive here. If she keeps doing that, we'll clock her for it. But I'm eager to keep watching.
So who was your favorite look? If you can't think of the name, I can get it for you. No worries.
Totally. Favorite look.
There were some really good looks.
Yeah. Oh, who was the queen that had the glove dress?
Mayhem Miller.
That was she won the challenge, and justifiably so. Mm-hmm. It was great. That was a wonderful look. I especially loved the glove, just like as the little hat.
Yeah, my favorite thing about that one is it looked really cool from far away, and then you got up close and you were like, "Holy shit, that's amazing!" Because you can see all the little details.
Yeah.
Mayhem Miller has been rumored to be on the show basically since it started, and just like hasn't gotten in every time. So I have been very eagerly anticipating her being on the show, and she did not disappoint.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
That face too, gorgeous face.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's fascinating to see a show where I guess it's the same for cooking competition shows a little bit, where these are people who are known in their respective communities for these things, and like seeing that reputation bleed over in small ways into the show proper is really interesting. Well, it's nice as someone who's a relative drag neophyte for me to like, based on the way other people talk about Mayhem Miller, I'm like, oh, this is how I get how important and influential she is in her respective community.
Totally.
So, yeah.
I really liked Monique Hart with the plastic hair.
Yes, that was really good.
Yes.
That was really inventive.
I thought Eureka's look was great, too.
What was her look? Who was?
She had like a Sweet 16 vibe going. She had the dog in the purse and the pink and the big skirt and all of that. I thought hers was really good.
I was a big fan of Ms. Cracker's look too, like with the broad brimmed hats, the sad 40s. Widow. She was playing sad widow. Yeah,
she
really
sold
nice.
The hell out of that.
Yeah.
I do not understand the whole "we're doing the exact same face" argument, because they weren't the same face. Their looks weren't similar. They weren't like, they're both skinny white girls. Like that's, it did not see, and drag queens would know more about it than I would, but they did not seem all that similar to me.
I think they're trying to like pull some black swan stuff going in this season.
Well, there's always an early rivalry. The tops of that, it looks like you're gonna meet Alyssa Edwards next week. Alyssa Edwards is a fucking Drag Race legend. One of those people who's just incredibly good at reality TV because they cannot help being every inch themselves. So they're like a quote factory. Everything they say is brilliant somehow, even when they're not trying to be. That's Alyssa Edwards. She also tongue pops a lot. I can't do it. She can, though. Right. Anyway, so when Alyssa Edwards was on, she is in the workroom, and then in comes Coco Montrese. And there was a scandal in the drag pageant world when one of them was crowned and then disqualified. No. And they think it's because the other person told tales, so then she got the crown. It was very showgirls. So they had this rivalry where they would just yell shit at each other until one of them got eliminated, until ultimately they had to lip sync against each other, and one of them got eliminated. Mm. And Alyssa won. Alyssa is a better drag queen than Coco. They're both very good. Coco has an incredible Janet. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Yes. Yeah. So these rivalries start early and tend to like grow. Some of them suck and some of them are actually pretty fun. Right.
Oh, I forgot about Blair St. Clair.
I like Blair St. Clair.
Yeah. Well, she's giving that like classic sort of Betty and Joan sort of realness.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's really great.
It looked like she was about to sing the Starlet solo from Annie. NYC. Like that. Yes. It made me laugh really hard. Yeah, she, I'm going to need a little more personality from her, but she was very good.
Well, I think that's the problem with that sort of persona is that you kind of inherently have to be reined in because it's the very Douglas Sirk sort of reserved housewife look.
Totally.
But you still got to stand out. Oh, and Monet Exchange.
Yes.
Was fun. Yeah, she was really great. Yeah.
She might be my favorite of the New York queens. I liked Ms. Cracker a lot too, but mm-hmm. She was very funny, but I liked Monet Exchange a ton. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think if there's anything else you absolutely have to know. Ross Matthews is reliably the funniest judge that isn't RuPaul.
Mm-hmm.
Carson is just Carson.
Yeah, Carson was almost like kind of a prude a little bit during some of the runway walks.
Yeah,
it's easily shocked.
He has a great fashion mind. Mm-hmm. He's not my favorite judge. I thought Christina Aguilera was a great guest judge.
Yes, she was a good guest judge. I still have weird hang-ups about her singing voice, but in the context of this, I know.
Why?
Is this the rift? I don't like that kind of showboating. I will not brook that kind of showboating in my musical taste. No, sir. I know. It's bad. It's something I need to work on.
No, you don't have to work on it. It's taste, but like, good God.
I know.
If you've got it, why not flaunt it?
I know.
That, when she sang that riff that she does at the beginning of Ain't No Other Man, I was like, oh, yes. And you can watch all these people. What's really fun is that when Lady Gaga showed up last season, season 9, Eureka similarly freaked out, like could not contain herself. So watching her do it again for Christina was really fun. Mostly I just want that wig, though. I want to know where Christina got that wig.
Yes. Absolutely.
And then I would like her to bring me the axe. A couple really essential RuPaul refrains that you've got to know.
Sure, yes.
One, if anyone ever asks you, how's your head? The only response is, I've never had any complaints.
Hold
way.
Let me write this down.
Yeah, take notes. That's the way one Drag Race fan recognizes another. Oh. And if you ever watch a queen, because she does it at least once a season, if Ru says, how's your head? Usually if there's a headpiece, they've somehow hit their head, or there's a big wig, or maybe they're bald or whatever, they'll be, how's your head? And if that queen goes, oh, it's fine. Or I thought I would do something a little different. You know, you're like, woof, what are you doing? Get it together.
Get a grip on yourself.
Everybody say love. It only works if you actually say love.
Mm.
At some point, you absolutely have to watch Drag Race in a gay bar. It's the best way to watch it.
Nice.
People cannot contain themselves. It's really fun. And if you're in Chicago, you should know, which Clint obviously is, we're sitting here, but if you listening are in Chicago, you should know, that Roscoe's in Lakeview often, almost weekly, has somebody from Drag Race there. Usually the current season's queens tend to rotate out through the season. So if you fall in love with somebody, it's a great way to see them. But this week they had Adore Delano, who's a previous runner-up there, singing. They had Trixie, who's the winner of All Stars there recently. So it's a really great way to see some of these people perform live. And they are really fucking good. So
nice.
Highly recommended. Well, thank you for doing this for me.
No problem. I plan on keeping track of the season and dropping in as I
we'll
can.
We'll have to talk about Snatch Game.
Yeah. I cannot wait to see this because you've told of the legends of Snatch Game.
I mean, when it's good, it's good.
Yeah.
There's one of the first All-Stars winner who was a runner-up in her season, in season 4, one of the best seasons of the show, is a professional Cher impersonator. That's what she does for a living, is she plays Cher. I mean, now she plays herself because she's also like a drag celebrity now. But So she did Cher on the Snatch Game, and she changed her wig like 4 times. Would just like sit back up with a different wig on, and it was so fucking funny. Like, just amazing.
Nice.
There's a great Judge Judy in your future. There's a great Anna Nicole in your future.
Okay.
My, like, favorite, Ben de la Creme, does Maggie Smith, and it's so fucking funny. There's a great Britney. There's
McGonagall
a great
Maggie
Carol
Smith
Channing.
Or Downton Abbey Maggie Smith?
Downton Abbey Maggie oh, okay. Smith. There might be a Harry Potter reference there in there or two, but mostly it's Downton.
Okay.
It's just really great. Anyway,
beautiful.
So I guess it's time to transition to our individual picks.
Sure.
And I'll let you do yours. Go. Okay. No, you do yours. All I've right, been flapping
sure.
my trap.
Sure. I think I mentioned last week that my next week on TV pick was the return of Brooklyn Nine-Nine for spring premiere in season 5, Safe House. And yeah, we just haven't talked about Brooklyn Nine-Nine a whole lot on the show yet, and I wanted to take this chance to sing its praises. It's just one of the smartest, most clever, just downright funny shows on sitcoms on TV right now. It's got a beautiful, killer ensemble. Andre Brower has played Captain Holt now, I think, longer than his Homicide Life on the Street character, which I think is hilarious, as hilarious as he is in the role. Like, he's just known for being such an intense, dramatic actor, but you place that in a comedic context, and it's great. This specific episode was about Captain Holt's husband, Kevin, being sort of targeted. Well, since he's targeted, he has to keep his husband safe, so he assigns Jake to keep him safe in his house, but sets out these specific rules where they can only crawl on the floor, or there's like 1 2-by-2-foot duct taped area in the living room where they can stand because there's no line of sight through the windows, that kind of thing. And it ends up like lasting months. And just they find all kinds of really wonderful gags. Andy Samberg and I think Mark Evan Jackson is the name of the Kevin. And they have a really nice rapport. They have since the beginning of the show, but it's nice to get them some wonderful in like close time together, especially with the constant threat of Jake having him see a Nick Cage movie eventually, and the reveal that he did break down and watch them all, and now he knows what Face Off is, and that's just something that shatters his little intellectual mind. Even with that sort of A plot, there's tons of fun B plots. You get to see Stephanie Beatriz play sort of a Jewish American princess going undercover to try to get information about where the assassins may be, and having Chelsea Peretti walk her through an entire long story to try to get the hairdresser to open up about her boyfriend's like mob connections and stuff. There's a lot of really great subplots. They make great use of the ensemble. You get to see Scully and Hitchcock rummage through shredded documents, Beautiful Mind style. It's pretty great.
I am so behind on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, so if it gets canceled, it's my fault.
Yeah.
I have to catch up because I am really excited. This is probably a good point to mention that Brooklyn Nine-Nine is one of those shows on the cancellation bubble. So if you happen to be a Nielsen house, even if you don't watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, you should just know there are a bunch of people out there that love it deeply. So maybe just like turn it on and go cook or something, even
Do
if you're not
solid.
Into it. Just like get in there. This is also our weekly plea for you to please, for the love of God, watch One Day at a Time.
Yes.
Because if that show gets canceled, I might throw myself off a building. Like, I'm feeling really invested in it.
Yeah.
Especially after having spoken to Isabella Gomez.
Right, which we will have a brief mini-sode in the coming days. We'll have the full interview for that. Yeah.
So you'll get to hear how charming she is, because she's very charming.
Yes, as is the show.
So my pick of the week was the finale for American Crime Story, The Assassination of Gianni Versace, called Alone. Clint and I both checked this one out. You mainlined most of the show.
I went hardcore, like the entire season. I watched about 3.5 episodes of American Crime Story, followed by the premiere of Drag Race. So I had a busy night last night.
Well, we're living in a gay fantasia, because,
indeed,
my God, that's a lot of look.
Yeah.
Because then you would have gotten the jumpsuit, right? So you got that's a little drag show in and of itself.
Yeah,
you got
absolutely.
Him twirling to whip it, and then you got to watch. So I think that this was ultimately a fairly uneven season of American Crime Story, but it's nevertheless a very good one. I'm a little disappointed with the fact that it's gotten so much less attention than the People versus OJ did. I've seen a couple of, God, I should have pulled up the exact article. I saw a great piece, maybe I can find it on Twitter really fast, yesterday, about why we still have some hesitancy about queer stories. and why that may be part of why it hasn't gotten the attention that People vs. O.J. has. It's also just not as good as the People vs. O.J.
Yeah.
But Darren Criss is every bit as good
right.
as all of those incredible performances.
He's sort of
were.
Elevating the rest of that. Yeah. I mean, and also, if I was more week to week on it, I probably would have nominated the previous episode for one of my picks of the week, because just sheer on the based on the sheer strength of the guy who plays Andrew Kananen's dad,
mm-hmm.
who's a phenomenal actor.
Yeah.
But yeah, and he makes a brief appearance in this too. No, I totally agree. It for something that ends with SWAT teams, Snidell alert, storming a house and, you know, gunshots and everything, it felt like a pretty sedate episode. Mm-hmm. Well, because so much of the appeal of the episodes, especially in Darren Criss's performance, is seeing him bounce off these other people and trying to impress them with his pathological lying and this sort of Patrick Bateman-y sort of skin that he wears. And this is him finally laid bare. And it gives Darren Criss a lot of moments for wonderful, like, nonverbal acting and internalizing and everything. But I guess to a certain extent, the novelty of Andrew Kananen's persona wanes a little bit since he's spending so much time in that houseboat sort of contemplating what to do next.
Yeah. At the same time, though, I think it's some of his best work on the show for that reason, mm-hmm. right? Like there aren't a lot of narrative fireworks going off.
Yeah.
It's just, I was particularly struck by him taking the scarf and going to sit on the balcony with the bottle of champagne to watch the helicopters searching for him.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of like, he gives this sort of contented sigh and then looks a little bit empty, like he got what he wanted and then nothing
enough.
Happened.
Yeah.
It was a little on the nose, but the juxtaposition of that scene with the scene with Max Greenfield and Dasha Polenko talking about how nobody saw him and he's not hiding. He wants to be seen. That whole scene was, mm-hmm. I thought, really interesting.
Definitely.
And I loved the scene in the opera house that
yes.
calls back to the premiere. It would have to have been much longer because I think the focus was exactly in the right place. I wouldn't have wanted to spend any less time with any of Andrew's victims.
Right.
Because I think that's part of what made the series work, is that it wasn't, while it is absolutely the portrait of a serial killer, they don't sideline his victims in the pursuit of like telling a story about this monster.
Yeah.
Which is one of the drawbacks of doing true crime stories, is you tend to sensationalize or even lionize the person who did the killing and
yeah.
turn all these people who lost their lives into plot devices. And ACS Versace doesn't do that at all. Like
right,
completely
right.
avoids that, which I think is really incredible.
Especially
but
with Cody
time,
Fearn and Finn Wittrock.
Yes.
I keep wanting to call him Finn Wolfhard, but that is a different Finn.
That is a different Finn.
But I would love a
dark-haired, ivory-skinned
yeah.
Finn.
But I would love them to do a show together.
I actually didn't expect to see any more of Judith Light. I'm really glad that she was
yeah.
back and that story kept getting told.
Mm-hmm.
I thought her work was some of the best in the finale.
Yeah.
And that run of episodes where we first see that story and then see the Cody Fearn story and then see the Finn Wittrock story, I think is like maybe the strongest chunk in the series.
Well, it was a really daring structure, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, and I appreciated the way they outlined all of that. And I think maybe part of the jarring element of the finale is the fact that it sort of abandons that structure. It goes
mm-hmm.
back to immediately after Versace's killed and is the aftermath.
Which it sort of has to, yeah.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I joked last week about how it just be the birth of Gianni Versace. it's the right way for the show to go. And I love the back and forth between the setup of Andrew's dad coming to get him and then like seeing him like taking that chance to grab some fame and notoriety, the dad in the interview.
And money. We're
and
thinking
money.
He's going to get money.
Yeah, like the whole autobiography thing. And yeah, it's that part really hit home for
yeah.
me. Like that was a really tragic moment.
Yeah, so I wish that while I wouldn't have wanted to go away from any of those victims, I wish that we had gotten to spend some more time with Edgar Ramirez, who I think also does
yeah.
really incredible work. And that scene with Andrew, the scene with Criss in the opera house, is I think a really great indicator of that. But I also thought that Penelope Cruz and Ricky Martin, bless him, did really great work.
Want to hear something funny?
Yes.
I didn't know until episode 9 that was Ricky Martin.
Really?
Yeah.
He's great, isn't he?
Julie and I were watching it, and I just happened to catch the credits because I don't super pay attention to the credits when they roll. I'm like, Ricky Martin's in this? And she's like, are you kidding me? Like, yes. Who does he play? And I had to find out later. And then like, oh, okay, I guess I get it. But yeah. Like, yeah.
He's great though, isn't he?
Yeah, he's really good.
I don't think there's a sour note casting. I mean, that's like the Ryan Murphy secret sauce is that he's building this repertory company of people who are loyal to him. And then he gets great performances out of them.
A good 66% look like the exact same flaxen haired twink, you know. But yeah.
I think that Edgar Ramirez was great. Penelope Cruz was great. Mm-hmm. Ricky Martin was great. Those scenes were really upsetting where you're realizing that he's going to be shut out of the, which is true. That really happened. Mm-hmm. He's that person is still alive. He's a fashion designer. The company basically took away pretty much everything that Gianni had tried to leave him, mm-hmm. Which is deeply upsetting.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what the show does really well is it's telling this story about people who are much more than gay, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, they contain multitudes, but the circumstances of their lives are directly affected by their sexual orientation in a life-altering active way that, on the one hand, we've certainly evolved now that we're living in a time, hopefully we'll keep living in a time when gay people can get married, mm-hmm. where same-sex marriage is legal. We no longer have a situation where there's any question about what rights a spouse might have. Mm-hmm. That's really important.
I mean, the cynical part of me does not think that the recent reassertion of the transgender ban on military services is a particularly good omen.
No.
But
no, it's a really bad omen.
Yeah.
Which is why I say hopefully still.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of why, and there's no way they could have known this when they started making it. I mean, originally the Katrina season was supposed to air before the Versace season.
Oh.
And I don't know exactly why those were switched, but I think whatever the reason behind it, this was a really good time to tell this story because it's not that long ago and not all of those advances are permanent advances.
Like we
so it's
have
good to be reminded of the cost of forcing people into the closet, of treating them like they're less than.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and especially with the military context too, where there's a whole subplot about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And
that episode is so good.
Finn Wittrock. Yeah, it's a really, really good episode.
That's the best that Finn Wittrock has been in anything for Ryan Murphy.
Right, like, especially after an American Horror Story season where he basically tried to be Andrew Cunanan, and Darren Criss does it so much better.
Oh, God. Darren Criss, I can't wait for him to get that Emmy nomination.
We know it's coming. It has to.
It's just, he's so good. Let me put it this way. There are these moments where in any movie, TV show, great movie, TV show, where it just kind of gets burned in your brain. But with a television show, I think it's more interesting because when those moments pop out, they then resonate in different ways for sometimes a really long time, mm-hmm. as opposed to just when you're thinking about the movie. You can be thinking about something else entirely. You can think about a different storyline, and all of a sudden that moment will pop into your head. I think a lot about the moment where Snidell alert for the Americans, I guess, where Philip takes his wig off in front of Martha and she's just kind of shaking. Mm-hmm. I think about that moment a lot. There are some other, like, I mean, any TV show, like, they're always. I think about You Stupid Bitch from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend a lot, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the moment when he's in the club and someone asks what he does and he starts rattling off the list of all the things he is and gets, like, slightly more manic and defiant and upset and proud all at the same time, mm-hmm. is one of the best pieces of acting.
Well, and we know where that comes from, too. Yeah.
Like, well, and then learning, learning that some of those things are actually true. Not just lies that he repeats, but actually true things.
Right.
It's just crazy.
Like the master bedroom thing, like the fact that his dad worked at Merrill Lynch, quote unquote.
Yep.
Like, yeah, no, that stuff is fantastic. I mean, normally recognizing when an actor's wheels are turning or when a character's wheels are turning and everything and seeing that internal life, sometimes that can be a criticism. But with Darren Criss, Andrew Cunanan, it's just like that's an essential part of the character because you have to see that artificiality and you have to see the constant different tactics that he's taking in order mm-hmm. to establish this persona for himself and sort of fake it till you make it to a certain point that he believes a lot of the stuff that he's saying. Mm-hmm. And then just whenever those moments when he like gets raw and someone prods at that facade enough to set him off, like is really, really frightening. And he manages all of those elements perfectly.
It was such a Walter White moment when he's looking for a way out of the city, off the island.
Yeah.
And he has to ask that old man for directions.
Yeah.
And he says the old man is like, well, you know, they're looking for the guy who killed Versace. They're hunting for him. And he goes, oh, yeah, Andrew Cunanan. I hope they find him, right? Because he cannot resist the urge to make sure that somebody knows his name, yeah, despite the fact that it will inevitably cast suspicion on him, is such a, it's such a Walter White moment. It's, oh, so...
He wants to be the one who knocks, you know?
Yeah, well, and he wants to get caught. It's hubris mixed with this self-destructive tendency.
Yeah.
That's just incredible.
Even in addition to that, I love the way the other characters around him recognize that part of him and yet are still somehow caught in his orbit for whatever reason, whether it's fear or pity or something else. Like, it's not just that he didn't pull the wool over a lot of people's eyes, like, at least eventually the people close to him. I love that inherent tension in most of these episodes of, like, seeing when people got sick of him, mm-hmm, and seeing how that happened. And then especially the reverse structure, like when we go with Finn Wittrock's character, like, we, when we first see him, he's already sick of him. And then you see that progression happen in reverse, the way he charms people knowing what happens later, mm-hmm, is such a clever piece of writing.
I think that relationship is particularly tragic because you can see how badly he needs that connection.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how, frankly, they both do. Like, it does seem like an actual friendship,
right,
that can't get over all of the bullshit. It's the same reason why that moment when he's talking to Cody Fearn's character in the hotel and he's like, listen, let's just have an honest conversation. And he tries and he gets like 30 seconds of truth out and then he falls back. It's just,
yeah.
I think that's part of why the brief scene where Lizzie is on television and is talking about how it's time to end this and you can do the right thing and I know the person I know and love is in there somewhere, mm-hmm, is so affecting because to a certain extent, she seems to understand him and isn't deceiving herself fully about who he is. May not know the extent of it, but isn't deceiving herself fully about who he is and loves him in spite of all of that.
Right.
And how badly that person must have needed that relationship.
I think she's the person that comes closest to knowing how to talk him down. Like, maybe that's the at least the best possible approach that isn't just arresting the guy.
Yeah.
It was a more subdued finale than I was expecting. Me but too. I think it still feels of a piece with the entire show, mm-hmm, which I think, you know, it's buoyed by a wonderful performance from Darren Criss, even if it doesn't quite, the whole thing doesn't quite reach the highs of People versus O.J. Simpson, but it's still a good season of television.
Yeah. Some great performances. I can't wait to see what Cody Fearn does next.
Yeah, absolutely.
I cannot wait. I mean, I'm not going to watch the seasons of House of Cards I missed, but I am actually absolutely going to watch the final season because Robin Wright.
Right.
But also because I just want to see him do more work. I think he was so good as David.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, Darren Criss, he's going to have his pick of projects, and I hope he picks some really good ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that does it for our episodes of the week.
Mm-hmm.
I think perhaps that means it is time for us to abscond to the ladies.
Yes, so we will sashay away.
Oh, well done.
I'm learning.
You're learning. We'll be right back. We're back. Do you want to talk about vaginas?
Do I have to?
Well, you get to.
Okay.
We're going to do last week, this week,
mm-hmm,
and we're going to talk about Full Frontal.
Yes.
And it's not, that's not the vagina part of it. I mean, Samantha Bee presumably has a vagina.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
No. God, there's a great segment on Full Frontal this week. Clint actually brought it to my attention, mm-hmm, as I had not caught up on Full Frontal for the week. And the whole episode is good. Did you watch the whole episode?
Yeah, I did. Because there's an act like before that specific segment still, yeah, about like women's pain and everything.
Yeah. But the specifically the women's pain segment where we talk about how nuts it is. First of all, how nuts it is that anyone is like, oh, we should probably make it really hard to get birth control, even though people use it for all kinds of health conditions,
right,
to say nothing of the fact that people should probably be able to choose whether or not they want to have a baby.
Right, exactly.
But also how nuts it is that that is the magic pill for basically everything.
Yeah.
And as a person who experiences a lot of pain, I can tell you when I started taking birth control, it was because my cramps were so bad, I would throw up at work.
Ooh.
That's shout out to the Barnes & Noble in Granville, Michigan, my first job ever, where I puked in the bathroom a whole bunch because, yay, my cramps were so bad. And what makes the segment great is not just that it's super important and relevant
and yeah,
nuts. It's that Laurie fucking Metcalf is in it.
Out of nowhere shows up with all these wonderful reenactments about the different ways that that women's problems, quote unquote, were treated throughout the centuries. And it's so great.
It's
and
so she, funny.
Well, because we know her from Lady Bird most recently, and also she's coming back for Roseanne, which is the reason that reminded me that Laurie Metcalf was also in a thing that I really liked this week. And it's also nice to see Sam B just do sketches again, especially, yep, with a wonderful scene partner like Laurie Metcalf. And she throws herself into the bits. And so that was really great.
Yeah. I don't want to say too much about it because I don't want to spoil any of it, but it's really great. Laurie Metcalf is always great. Sam B in a variety of wigs, always great.
Mm-hmm. And beards.
And beards. Mm-hmm. Lab coats. Also, shout out to the self-burn she makes in this episode where she talks about all of the mistakes that people made in the 90s, early 2000s, and reveals that she played Cinnabon cashier in The Love Guru. That made me laugh really hard.
Yeah, it's a really good segment.
So, Clint.
Yeah. What up?
I feel like we should get really specific.
Yeah? How specific? How granular do we want to go?
Well, let's just say overly. I think we should be overly specific.
You know what? I think that sounds like a plan.
Great. So what's your overly specific thing of the week?
Mine is the dark corporate synergy of the week. And that is NBC deciding to connect two of its shows in a really unexpected way. As TV Party listeners know, both of you, I have been following Good Girls week to week. And it's still shaping up to be a really, really interesting show. They're finding new ways to play with this premise that, like, when you watch the pilot, it feels like, oh, that's the thing. That's the thing they culminated in. Where do they go from here? They're taking it all kinds of interesting directions. And this latest one is the characters trying to find a way to launder all this money that they're sort of being forced, this counterfeit money that they can sort of go through. Their solution is to go to the Cloud Nine Superstore in their town, aka the brand from the NBC sitcom Superstore, and use that as a front. Something that they pitch to, like, the gang leader that they've been interacting with this whole time. And it's just a really clever way to reward Superstore fans by revealing the franchise's dark underbelly. And now I have to go back to Superstore and know that at least one of your branches is laundering money from the mafia or like the cartel or something. The allegiance, specific allegiance, is made unclear. But yeah, so that was my overly specific thing of the week. That was the moment that this week that made me go, what? The most.
Did you see, speaking of what? and in universe NBC stuff, did you see the reveal that The Good Place exists in the Parks and Rec universe? Because there are Dennis Feinstein perfume ads on the back of all of Eleanor's trashy magazines.
I didn't see it, but I did read about it like forever ago. Yeah.
It's so funny.
And it led to a flood of think pieces about like what Parks and Rec characters would end up in the good and bad places. Probably. Yeah.
Leslie Knope, obviously in The Good Place. Everybody else questionable.
Yeah. Like, for sure.
Everybody else questionable.
Except for Jerry.
Yeah, Jerry's definitely in The Good Place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good old Jerry Gergich.
Mm-hmm. Oh, jeez. What's yours?
My overly specific thing of the week is the Nat 20 of the week for a D&D scene that was a critical success. And that is the D&D underbelly, I guess two underbellies.
Yeah, a lot of
the most recent episode of Legends of Tomorrow, in which Death Witch Sarah Lance terrorized her shipmates. I actually think it's no surprise that I think Legends is great.
Yeah.
I know Clint also thought this episode was great. There are some really wonderful moments. The reveal that Rory is going to be the one to wield the fight. It's always weird for me to say Rory in the context of Legends of Tomorrow.
I know, in a show that also has Arthur Darvill in it. Yeah.
Mick, we'll say Mick, is going to be the one to wield the fire totem. I thought, I didn't somehow did not see coming at all. And it just seems really perfect.
Because it would feel redundant, you know, like, yeah.
They're continuing to do a really great job of finally differentiating between their nerdy, good looking white guys, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
The show is continuing to use each episode to sort of course correct in some areas they've been underdeveloped. And they get a little more development for literally every character this episode, which is great, including tying back one of the most fundamental things about Sarah Lance's character, which is that she had this experience, this death experience that led her to this very dark place, and she's killed a lot of people, and that matters.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, really, really great.
Yeah.
But it's not just that they're sitting around playing D&D, and that's amazing, and his hat is amazing, all of it's amazing. It's not just that he uses his experience as a D&D player to help them understand a way that they can reach the legends. It's that, I swear to God, my friend Neil, friend of the show, Neil Starbird, in the D&D campaign I've been playing with him for 3 years, we had a session where we walked into a strange mist and were each confronted by a very specific personal trauma. That really happened. That was as I was watching this, and I was watching Sarah confront all of her shipmates with these terrible experiences, with these heartbreaking experiences. It's like, this is just like that one time that we did that we played D&D, and Neil made every. My character is a half elf who resents the fact that her like elfish royal father abandoned her. So mine was something I was like hiding in a closet and listening to my evil elf dad, like leave, and I think maybe he was beating my mom. I don't remember. It was bad. Mm-hmm. That was my baby girl. She's refused to adopt her name because she is. Proudly an orphan, so she's not baby girl like baby girl. She's baby girl like she was
a baby,
girl Wind River.
It's a name that was given to her by her.
Yes, yeah. Nice, well done.
Thank you. Cheers.
So yeah, I not only loved the D&D references, mm-hmm. but it specifically connected to my own D&D experience, which was like a special kind of achievement unlocked for me.
Yeah.
If I was going to pick a genuine, overly specific thing from the episode, it would be the terrific wire work that they have Katie Lotz do, where she is constantly like floating up from the floor. And the person who directed the episode put an Instagram story out showing that scene being filmed. Mm-hmm. And like, think about the core control you have to make God. That shit look that good.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Katie Lotz is not just like a fantastic actress. She's a fantastic martial artist and athlete too, which is such a fundamental part of Sarah Lance. And that's why she's so compelling
to watch.
It's why
she's the Arrowverse secret weapon.
Yeah,
now exactly. That Victor Garber has departed.
R.I.P.D.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's definitely the Arrowverse secret weapon. And my favorite Arrowverse character, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And again, they continue to find new inventive ways to use Wally. My mm-hmm. prediction is he gets the Earth Totem because he needs to be grounded.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, since Constantine comes back, I'm really excited. And we got news again that Constantine, if the show gets renewed for season 4, he will be joining the main cast.
And that's pretty likely. Yes. The CW hasn't really announced much.
They're not one to really cancel a lot of shows, too.
Well, right now, because they have the distribution deal with Netflix where the CW, where their shows go basically right to Netflix as soon as the seasons are done. Mm-hmm. It's why you can currently watch season 3 of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, like, right now.
Yeah.
As opposed to waiting, like, 8 months. I think they have more faith in letting a show find an audience after it's already aired.
Yeah.
But with Legends, that isn't a problem. It's one of the it's firmly in the middle of the pack.
Yeah.
And is, with the possible exception of Black Lightning, which had a rocky couple episodes at the beginning, but which is on a very hot streak. The last 2 episodes are excellent.
Good, good.
Is the best Arrowverse show right now.
Nice.
Like, Supergirl has some really great moments and a great cast. The Flash has had a couple of good episodes this season.
Yeah.
But it's still bogged down in like its own heightened sense of how much we care about Barry's pain.
I hate that both the Arrow and the Flash are the bummer shows now.
I know. Because the thing is, Arrow would be far more palatable if it were the only bummer show.
Right.
I mean, they're
that's
really
the dark
dropping
corner.
The ball this
that's
season.
The Batman show.
Totally.
Well, that was what made Flash season 1 so cool. It was the refreshing, mm-hmm. you know, lighthearted counterpart to Arrow, but Flash has just followed suit. And it's just like,
Supergirl is still pretty good.
Yeah.
Black Lightning, like I said, is on a hell of a run. Mm-hmm. I'm firmly team Anissa. I like Anissa so much.
Anissa's great, yeah.
But Legends is just so doing such an incredible job of mm-hmm. even just correcting the relatively minor weaknesses they had in last season, which was a great season.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited for that one to continue.
For a show that has such a small budget, especially compared to the other Arrowverse shows, it's so inventive and so fun. And in the second and third seasons, it's really found its own sort of unique identity. And it knows what it is, and it is proud of that fact. And it knows how to have fun. And I just love it so much.
Speaking of Legends knowing what it is, this is not my pick for next week because it's not next week. But this is a good way to transition.
Yeah.
I had to check this 3 times to make sure it wasn't a mistake. An upcoming episode of DC's Legends of Tomorrow. The episode is titled Guest Starring John Noble. It's even better than if that Deadpool sequel is actually called Untitled Deadpool Sequel. Because that's funny.
Yeah.
But guest starring John Noble is...
It's genius.
Yum, 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 yum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I cannot... It's so funny. Well, I don't. What is the secret sauce in that writing room that they are having this much fun?
It's Helen Hunt caliber episode title.
Oh, better than.
Better than, yeah.
I think better because it's
they're
just
both in like the top tier.
Totally. Yeah. Well, like Legends of the Lost Art, Raiders of the Lost Art, sorry.
Yeah.
Also really good. But yeah, this is, I mean, Helen Hunt is, don't get me wrong, that's a really great title. But the meta, the, like, unremarked upon meta commentary, because you read the episode synopsis and it does not mention John Noble, like at all, who's voicing Malice, right? So it is a great way of telling us what to expect in that episode. Like, obviously, that's going to be a Malus confrontation. We know that because it's guest starring John Noble. But that's it. It's just, it's perfect.
Speaking of which, we never ended up revisiting the second half of Jessica Jones, but I did think it was funny that both Legends and Jessica Jones season 2 have a villain named Malus.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now that we've gotten our overly specific things of the week out of the way, let's talk about what we're excited about next week. Allison, what do you want to watch next week?
Oh, there's a lot of good stuff coming out next week. Mm-hmm. This would be a great point to mention that the revival of Roseanne begins. If you're hearing this on Monday, it would be the very next day. It has its ups and downs. The first episode in particular is a little bit rocky in places, but it's a good reminder of why Roseanne is one of the best sitcoms of all time. Mm-hmm. So I'm cautiously excited about that. You can read my review of The Revival of Roseanne on RogerEbert.com. I'm also very much looking forward to Barry, which is hitting HBO on Sunday. So you will have actually, it will be available for you to stream as you're listening to this. I just think that is a terrific cast. You can read Randall Colburn's review of the first season of Barry on consequenceofsound.net right now. Mm-hmm. So I'm really looking forward to that one. I assume you are as well.
Yes. If you had told me 10 years ago that HBO was putting out a show starring Henry Winkler called Barry, I would have presumed it was an Arrested Development spinoff that I would have very much been on board for. But I'm okay with this too.
Me too. I am super excited about the cast. I love Bill Hader. Mm-hmm. Randall's review is very positive, so I'm excited about that. And then I'm also looking forward to AMC's The Terror, which by the time you hear this, well, there will also be a review of that at consequenceofsound.net from me. I have not started watching it yet. I'm very excited. Mm-hmm. That has a fucking incredible cast, including one of my very favorite under-heralded actors of the television world, Tobias Menzies, who, if you happen to also listen to Podlander Drunkcast and Outlander Poundcast, you will know that we no longer call him Tobias Menzies, which is what we called him for a long time. but when, Snidell alert for Outlander, when his character exited Outlander, he is so good on that show that we retired Menzies and now just call him Tobias Menzies again. Anyway, I'm very excited to watch him do all of his jaw acting.
Yes, very chiseled. Yeah, well, also Jared Harris, Karen Hines, I think, is in that too. Yeah, a bunch of like, well, it feels like AMC is like, well, Walking Dead starting to run out of steam. Well, starting. I say starting. But it's like, let's do a horror show, but instead of zombies, scurvy, like cholera and shit, and also probably like a sea monster of some kind.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looks really, really interesting.
It's based on a novel by Dan Simmons, 2007 novel, and there is a character in it called Lady Silence. This is what I'm learning from the Wikipedia page right now. And Ridley Scott is executive producing. That's exciting.
Nice.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, so yeah, I am very excited about that. What about you?
Well, speaking of Ridley Scott adjacent projects,
nicely done.
I do what I can. I'm actually really, really excited for the premiere of Trust, the new FX show. That is basically the second telling of the kidnapping of John Paul Getty III we've had in like 4 months.
It's really weird how this happens.
Yeah, yeah. But I had that same thought. And so if you go to Consequence of Sound in the next few days, you will see a piece basically comparing Trust to All the Money in the World and the way it handles its differing elements and like why it might be necessary to tell this same story A, now, and B, with these two different formats. But anyway, Trust, again, like, it tells the story of John Paul Getty III, the golden hippie, as he's called by some of the characters, who is kidnapped, and he's the heir to the Getty Oil fortune, which is headed by Donald Sutherland's J. Paul Getty. It's this 10-part miniseries that all episodes are directed by Danny Boyle, all episodes are written by Simon Beaufoy, who writes a lot of Danny Boyle's movies, like Slumdog and 127 Hours and stuff like that. I've seen the first two-ish episodes, and I also reviewed All the Money in the World, which you can also find that review at consequenceofsound.net. But it takes a much more freewheeling, campier approach to the material than All the Money in the World, which is still like still has its moments, especially with Christopher Plummer, who is actually really good. I think he deserved that nomination for doing all that great work in 9 days. There's a high camp dynasty feel to a lot of the stuff in like J. Paul Getty's Sutton Place, his palatial mansion filled with art and his harem of varying aged women, including Anna Chancellor. It's very similar in tone to American Crime Story, where it's going to take like it's going to focus on one differing element of this crime and this event through these different perspectives. Like the first episode is about J. Paul Getty and sort of establishing his life in Sutton House. But then episode two really picks up steam with the real star of the picture, which is Brendan Fraser. He is back, baby. And he is Fletcher. He's Fletcher Chase, who's played by Mark Wahlberg in the movie. But he plays him so much more interestingly because he's not just Mark Wahlberg. Brendan Fraser, he's, you know, we haven't seen him in a while, but yeah, now he's back with this. He's wearing his age really nicely. He has this bolo tie and Stetson hat with this like that mummy Encino Man charm is still there. But now it's filtered through this like really snarky like southern accent and everything. And he's carrying himself so well. And it's just it's a star performance. And I just like Darren Criss, I want Brendan Fraser to get some fucking Emmys for this show because it's going to be great. Yeah. And Danny Boyle, he films it in the same sort of freewheeling style he always does. It reminded me of things like Trance and a little bit of 127 Hours and a little bit of Trainspotting too. So like, Trainspotting also. So I get confused there. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a fantastic series. Donald Sutherland is killing it, especially for a man his age to be so vital and so energetic and just to carry this show on his, you know, a comparatively frail figure. Like, it's so great. And I have a good feeling about the rest of the show.
Well, I am excited for it too. I'm fully on board for the Fraserissance.
Yes.
Well, I think that's it for us, yeah?
Except for the Discovery Special of the Week.
As always, yes. My very favorite part of the show. Clint was very excited about this one. He accidentally deleted it and almost lost his mind because he couldn't remember what it was. And then yes. He found it again. So, Clint, what is our Discovery Special of the Week?
Well, I should point out that at first, my backup, in case I hadn't found it, was some episode of some like Discovery-led trucking series, but the episode title was Big Rig Gig, which I thought was pretty fun. But yep. then I found this later. This is a History Channel special called The Curse of Civil War Gold.
I love it.
I will freely admit I added the exclamation point of my own volition. I don't think the title itself has it, but it is sorely missing it.
Yeah. Well, the exclamation point makes it, so that's good editing. That's good copywriting.
Thank you.
Discovery or History Channel.
Get on it.
You should really hire Clint because he sold me on this one.
Yes, The Curse of Civil War Gold. As far as I can tell, it's just going to be a special about like this hidden cache of, well, Civil War gold that like has, you know, all manner of terrible things befall those who find it or come across it. And I don't know a whole lot about it, but just based on sheer title alone, I will happily watch something called The Curse of Civil War Gold.
Does that mean you're also a fan of The Legend of Curly's Gold?
Yes.
Okay, just making sure.
Yeah. The only thing that you could improve The Curse of Civil War Gold with is if you add an adventurer's name on the front of it. Like Indiana Jones and the Curse of Civil War Gold.
Scooby-Doo and the Curse of Civil War Gold.
Harry Potter and the Curse of Civil War No. Gold. No?
No.
Percy Jackson?
Percy Jackson works.
Yeah, maybe.
Katniss Everdeen? Yeah. I don't know.
Jessica Fletcher and the Curse of Civil
yes,
War Gold.
Yes, 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 yes. Yes. Yes, I wrote a lot about Jessica Fletcher this week because we have, you can also find this on consequenceofsad.net. We had a big crop of procedurals, one of which is Deception.
I have not watched the second episode. How is it after the pilot?
I mean, about what you'd expect.
Yeah.
I have a series recording set on my DVR.
There you go.
The next one takes place in an art museum.
Okay.
I watched basically all the new procedurals that came out this month and wrote about four of them plus Rise, because that's another formula show. Which isn't a bad thing. Formulas can be good.
Yeah.
It's just they're a mixed bag. But one of them is Instinct on CBS, which I actually cautiously recommend. It is very much by the book. It's about what you expect.
Is Alan Cumming like carrying it?
Yes. Yeah. Well, and that's the comparison I make is Murder, She Wrote is a better show. But what made Murder, She Wrote really special is that it had Angela Lansbury. What makes Instinct really special is that it has Alan Cumming. In both cases, it centers on a writer who then aids in law enforcement investigations, sometimes on their own, presumably. The big difference here, and I guess this is a Snidell alert for the premise of Instinct, this happens in like the first 20 minutes, is that he's a retired CIA operative as well as a writer. So this cop brings him on thinking like, oh, well, I mean, he does criminology. He's a criminology professor, sociology professor. It's a killer is using his book to send messages or whatever. And then he's like, well, I'm going to go talk to somebody I know and get some information. I'll be back. She's like, can I come? And he's like, no, you can't. Sorry. You can't come. So he just let you think he's going to, like, I don't know, talk to his publisher or something. Publisher, Whoopi Goldberg.
No kidding.
Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, shit.
So he walks away, doop, 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 in his fabulous suits. And walks into, like, a CIA bunker where he talks to Naveen Andrews.
Okay.
Because he used to be in the CIA. And Naveen Andrews is like, you're the best there ever was. He's like, well, I wanted other things because now he's married. The other thing that makes Instinct really special is that his character is openly gay.
Okay.
So it's a CBS procedural, which is very by the books, except for, oh, my God, openly gay protagonist, which is pretty great for CBS.
Yeah.
So, yeah, cautiously recommend it. Anyway, nice. He's no Jessica Fletcher, but he's pretty good.
Right. I have a question.
Yes.
How much better would Deception be if Alan Cumming was the magician?
Oh, God.
What if they swapped leads?
Well, I wouldn't watch Instinct at all.
Yeah, but you can combine the best of both worlds.
Jesus Christ. Can you even imagine? I'm, like, legitimately tearing up a little, especially if they just let him use that Scottish brogue. Well, first of all, Alan Cumming's American accent is way better than Jack
Cudmore Scott.
I was about to say Jack Cameron Mitchell, but that's John Cameron Mitchell. His American accent is way better, but especially if they let him just be Scottish.
Mm.
First of all, I would absolutely go see an Alan Cumming magic show. I don't even like magic shows, and I would go in a heartbeat. I'd see Alan Cumming do anything. second, he's just so fucking charming and mysterious.
Which is what you need when you're a magician.
Yes.
Jack Cumber, like, Scott is just like a frat
that
boy.
Apple-cheeked thing. I don't get it.
Yeah.
Who else would you want to see? And who else would make you want to watch Deception more?
Oh, God. He's too big for it, but maybe Paul Bettany. I don't know.
Clive Owen.
Paterson Joseph.
Yes. But they'd have to lend him from Timeless.
Yeah, that's true.
Timeless is staying pretty good, by the way.
Yeah, good, good. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I saw the second episode. It was pretty solid. Yeah. that was a good sort of, especially placing Malcolm Barrett, teaching the nod, which was a wonderful moment.
Yeah, Malcolm Barrett. Rufus invented the nod. It's great.
Yes, yes. TV,
Instinct,
huh?
I cautiously recommend it. Mm-hmm. If you like a procedural, which I do.
Yeah.
I guess that's TV.
It's true.
Did we talk about enough TV?
I don't know.
God, there's so much shit we didn't talk about for the week, but you
so,
know what?
So much.
I'm getting a new couch today. I have to go get my new couch.
Oh, good. Well, then you can watch TV
great.
On said couch.
I have serious back problems because I've been sitting on a shitty futon in my quote unquote office, which is my living room in front of my television.
Yes, same.
So
I need to get a new couch. There's like one of the legs is slowly sinking and stuff, and I fear that one day we're just gonna sit down too hard on that couch and half of the couch is just gonna collapse.
Yeah. Oh no.
Whoops.
Well, that's going to do it for us. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to no one for being here.
Yes.
Fuck Caroline Cito. Just kidding. I love Caroline Cito.
Yes.
You can find us on Twitter at TV Party COS. I swear to God, we'll start using it really soon.
Yeah.
You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/consequenceofsound. If you have a question you'd like answered, you can email us at tvparty@consequenceofsound.net. We would love to answer questions about television for you.
Mm-hmm.
You can say things like, hey, so what did you think of those other CBS or those other procedurals? And I will say they were fine. You can say things like, hey, is Rachel Bloom really as cool as she seems on television? And I will say, I don't know. I haven't met her, but she was very nice on the phone. You can say, Clint, is that what you sound like all the time? And he will say, yes, this is what I sound like all
the time. After stammering for about 5 seconds.
Anyway, you can email us, and that would be awesome.
You can find me on Twitter at AlcoHollywood, and you can also find me as the co-host of the podcast AlcoHollywood, which you can find at AlcoHollywood.com, and Nathan Rabin's HappyCast, which you can find at NathanRabin.com.
You can find me at Allison Shu on Twitter. You can also find me on the podcast Debating Doctor Who at Debating DW. We are currently going through the Brigadier Chronicles, and my co-host Alistair Wilkins is introducing me to the Brigadier, which is great. You can also listen to me on Podlander Drunkcast, an Outlander podcast, which is exactly what it sounds like, and you can find that podcast on Twitter at PodlanderCast.
You can leave us a review on iTunes, Podchaser, Google Play Music, whatever your podcast platform may be. TV Party is a production of the Consequence Podcast Network. Check out our expanding roster of music, film, and television podcast programming at consequencesound.net. If I may take a moment to editorialize, we just released a brand new podcast called Filmography, headed by our editor, Dominic Suzanne Mayer, about the films of Wes Anderson. And check out the first episode. Allison's on it. She's pretty great.
Allison's on the second one. He's pretty great, too.
Thank you so much for listening. This show is recorded and produced in Chicago, Illinois, and recorded and engineered by the person drinking Diet Pepsi.
I'm drinking a beer at 11:30 in the morning.
Just morning beer. Living, that's the real Chicago way.
Yes, God.
Clint Worthington. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week with more television and also some of the scariest moments in TV history. I'm excited about that one. Bye.
Bye.
Consequence Podcast Network.